Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
I'm Leo. And tonight we have a special guest is Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union. And he's going to talk to us tonight about a number of union issues that have come up and recently. And and we have Pete Wood coming up.
In the ring, Woody in the ring.
Tonight at
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. So, between now and then, we will read you and give you some news. A lot of things actually have come up recently that I wanted to mention. I'm not sure if I want to start here, politics or...
Did you want to start with Ralph Nader, his little bit?
No, not really. I thought I'd save that for later.
For the end.
Yeah. But what I wanted to do is we got a number of health articles tonight.
How about on Obama there? There are new sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, we could start with that if you want. I really wanted to go with something different here tonight. This article probably bothered me the most, and it's called "A Numbing Out of America," and public apathy explained. And what it means, what this is regarding, is the everybody knows now that chemtrails exist. Okay,
most
people do. And there's enough evidence to show it, and it just people are just in complete denial if they don't see it. But
and who's this by?
This is by Alan Rowland, and this is from the VT Veterans Today.
Well, they have often have good articles.
Yeah, very good articles.
Big picture of chemtrails too.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's kind of Photoshop, but
yes, I see that it has skulls on the airplane.
Connect the dots. The constant aerial bombardment of chemtrails, the continued fluoridation of our water, and the acceptance of genetically modified foods has pacified Americans to the extent that they willingly submit to the dictates of the corporate state, to the disintegration of their liberties, and to the inevitability of a new world corporate order, where the only choice is the sedating blue pill of public apathy.
The numbing of America through the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat can only be clearly seen when we seek the red pill of the truth and let go of our addiction to the sedating blue pill of apathy and unquestioned conformity. In other words, it's taking the blue pill of eternal, unquestioned government allegiance or bondage and submitting to authority versus the red pill of critical thinking, individuality, and searching for the truth. Morpheus explains it all to Neo in The Matrix. Neo, like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born inside a prison that you cannot smell, taste, or touch, a prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what The Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
I can play that right now.
At last. Welcome to you. As you no doubt have guessed, I am Morpheus. It's an honor to meet you. No, the honor is mine. Please, come, sit. I imagine that right right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole.
You could say that.
I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he's expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Do you believe in fate, Neil?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my life.
I know exactly what you mean. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Thanks.
Global financial elite feel more than terrorism or any foreign threat is the people armed with the truth. But what a better way to keep the masses at bay than spraying them with an immune system weakening aerosol, sedating them with fluoride, and finally slowly weakening them with genetically modified foods, which are foods derived from genetically modified organisms.
Let's review all three of these and their global consequences. Chemtrails. The other day, I saw an incredible number of these persistent jet contrails in the sky above the city in which I live. But at times, I have been physically affected by them in terms of noticeable throat and lung congestion. Chemtrails, once considered a conspiracy theory, are now admitted by the U.S. government to be a very real geoengineering program. The problem: chemicals with known health effects are being sprayed above our heads on a daily basis and without any real understanding of their purpose or potential long-term health effects, and in particular, respiratory effects. And there's another short video here that they have you do, but it's on chemtrails. But Dan
The truth warrior is right.
I myself am a pilot for over 10 years, and I worked in the aviation field for about the same amount of years. And from a professional point of view, I can say that there is a huge difference between condensation, contrails, and chemtrail. A condensation trail dissipates as the jet moves along. A chemtrail will stay and expand into man-made clouds used for various weather experiments loaded with toxic chemicals that we breathe in on a daily basis. Chemicals include arsenic, aerosol, barium, depleted uranium, high levels of mercury, aluminum, and several other toxic chemicals. They are a huge cause in most respiratory breathing problems in America.
Maybe that's why we have such an increase in childhood
pneumonia,
asthma,
sure.
And pneumonia.
Yeah. I did a beta test on how many cases of an ambulance being called within an 8-hour period for respiratory problems. People of all ages, infants to elderly, that can't breathe. I worked in a facility in Springfield, Mass., where I monitored operations and had a police fire scanner. I monitored an average of 8 to 13 calls every day within an 8-hour period of people who could not breathe.
B. Diondi rightfully concludes, once these chemicals are sprayed, several hours later they descend towards ground level, and the human body inhale these toxic fumes. You may ask if wearing a gas mask is safe. Well, you may protect your lungs, but also remember the plants breathe these chemicals in as well, affecting your foods grown in water you drink, along with the already added poison sodium fluoride and all its derivatives to the water, and GMO food crops incorporated by your friends at Monsanto. And finally, Alex Jones, Infowars.com, reports on November 13, 2011, that NASA reported 5 years ago that the Earth is now receiving at least 20% less sunlight than 10 years before. After 16 years of denial, the White House science czar, John P. Holdren, now admits they have been testing the manipulation of Earth's atmosphere with barium salts, aluminum dioxide, and other toxic compounds. Bottom line, there is a worldwide secret program to manipulate the atmosphere. They admit it's happening, but they won't tell us why. And then there's another
video. Yeah, fluoridation. One of the reasons I drink clean and filtered bottled water is because of the menace of fluoridation. As I become more and more aware of why so many people are blind to the realities of the growing tyranny all around us, I realize they've been drugged. It was good enough for the gulags and the concentration camps. Well, then, by golly, it's good enough for you. Wake up, man. How can you take the red pill if you're swallowing the blue one? Here's the stuff they don't want you to know about fluoridation. Now, I could play this, but you know this is going to take up a good half hour.
Just know that fluoride
is really bad.
And you can go to this site, and we'll give it to you when we're finished,
right,
to watch some of these videos. Genetically modified foods, and they just say in this brief video, Jeffrey M. Smith, author of Seeds of Deception, explains the difference between corporate science and independent science. The difference between the two can only lead you to call the former a bunch of liars. The foods and drugs these corporate scientists lie about affect our immune systems, our reproductive systems, and our overall health. Basically, they'd feed us poison if the company told them to sell it to us, and that's exactly what they're doing, with the main culprit being Monsanto. In addition, 19 studies link GMO foods to organ disruption.
We might want to play that. It's only 2 minutes long.
Yeah, let me play
this one. Yeah. And I wanted to play this because behind the big GMO research here.
In the world of genetically modified foods, there's two types of science: corporate science and independent science. Corporate science is science in the corporate interest, not in the consumer interest. Monsanto tells us, trust us, we're experts. our GM foods are safe. This is the same company that told us PCBs were safe, Agent Orange was safe, DDT was safe. And now they're telling us that our genetically modified foods are safe. And how they do it is amazing. For example, when they wanted to say that pasteurization destroys the bovine growth hormone in the milk, scientists pasteurized the milk 120 times longer than normal. When Monsanto wanted to say that their genetically modified soy was substantially equivalent to non-GM soy, they left key data out of their study, which showed that their GM soy had as much as 7 times the amount of a known allergen. Here's my favorite. When Monsanto was trying to introduce their genetically modified high lysine corn, they said that this new protein has a history of safe use in the food supply, so it's safe. Because this protein is naturally found in soil, and we obviously eat soil and the residues on fruits and vegetables. So, a scientist called their bluff and figured out how much corn an average male American would eat, and how much of that protein he would eat. And then calculated how much soil he'd have to eat. Someone would have to eat 22,000 pounds of soil every second, 24 hours a day. These guys have bad science down to a science. It's ridiculous, ridiculous. They used the wrong control group, the wrong statistical method, the wrong detection method. Here's the point. We can't trust the same scientists that told us that PCBs were safe, that DDT was safe, that Agent Orange was safe. We need to look at independent studies by independent scientists that aren't trying to prove a point. And they're finding that GMOs are quite unsafe. So, ignore the corporate science, look to the independent science, and choose non-GMO foods.
If we could get some labels, that'd be great. According to the Institute for Responsible Technology, the GMO soybean and corn variety... I already read that. I read it before we played that. In addition, 19 studies link GMO foods to organ disruption. The GMO soybean and corn varieties used in the feeding trials constitute 83% of the commercialized GMOs that are currently consumed by billions of people. While the findings may have some serious ramifications for the human population, the authors demonstrate how a multitude of GMO-related health problems could easily pass undetected through the superficial and largely incompetent safety assessments that are used around the world. According to Forbes, Monsanto is so despised by environmentalists that Google's first suggested search term for the St. Louis company is Monsanto Evil. Readers voted Monsanto the world's worst evil corporation in a January poll, giving the corporation a whopping 51% of this vote.
Obesity. Among all developed countries, Americans are the fattest people in the world. The World Health Organization found over 60% of the American population is obese or overweight. Even more disturbing, the U.S. is the only country in the developed world to label obesity a national security health risk.
Top Pentagon officials have warned Americans are becoming so fat, most of the volunteering for the Army are disqualified because of their size. Child obesity is also on the rise in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control estimates 1 in every 3 American kids are either obese or overweight. Jeffrey Smith, the author of Seeds of Deception, points to the mass production and consumption of genetically modified foods in the U.S. as the most probable source of this ongoing problem. Watch this RT interview with the hypocrisy of both Barack and Michelle Obama are laid bare with the appointment of several key Monsanto people to the Obama administration and the FDA. Yeah, well, she promotes exercise.
Then they allow this crap to go on. I love to play this, but it's a 6-minute interview, but, you know, we're running down the clock here. So there you have it. America is being numbed out through the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, as the corporate global elite ply their trade at the expense of a sedated and apathetic public. It can only get worse, and here's a recent example. Recently, 2 million live virus oral vaccine / Bates units were dropped by airplane all over the state of Texas to protect animals and humans from rabies. Each package was dipped in fish oil and fish meal crumbles to make the vaccine bait appealed to animals. The claim is that these packages are harmless. However, they do contain a live virus. Yet, are they also add that should you come in contact with one and you have an easily compromised immune system, you should contact your physician immediately. Okay? Our society is run by insane people for insane objectives. I think we're being run by maniacs for maniacal ends, and I think I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that. That's what's insane about it. That's from John Lennon. And take the red pill before it's too late.
The author is Alan L. Rowland, is a freelance alternative press online columnist. He's also a practicing psychotherapist, author, and lecturer, who shares a daily political and social commentary on his website at ellenrowland.com. He also guest hosts A Truth Talk, a national radio show that airs monthly.
Okay. So, anyway.
Good article you put together.
Yeah, I'd like to get him on the show one day. Maybe we could get him. So, this is... It's staggering, folks. It's staggering. Now, the article, you can go to VT, or just put in Veterans Today, okay, .com, I believe. It just says Veterans Today. So.
And look for the article, Numbing Out of America, Public Apathy Explained.
It's really frightening.
By Alan Rowland. And there's several good videos that we didn't get a chance to play that I think you'll find very informative.
Yeah, I think so. And, let's see, I wanted to, that one was frightening to me.
Uh-huh.
This one was kind of
why the right wing is petrified of letting voters vote instead of the Electoral College.
Right. I like this article. What it's saying is that the right, the entire country so far, our governing body,
1%.
Right, doesn't want this. But you know, it's good that we should have the entire. It should presidents and politicians should be elected by
the
popular
people.
Vote, not by goddamn Electoral College. Why the right wing is petrified of letting voters instead of the Electoral College pick presidents. A movement to reform the Electoral College and elect the president based on the national popular vote is half the states it needs. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell calls it absurd and dangerous. The Wall Street Journal says it deserves to die. The Heritage Foundation called it unconstitutional. And the Washington Post calls it flawed. A Republican National Committee resolution says it is a radical, un-American, unquestionably legal maneuver. It is awarding the presidency to the candidate who wins the most votes.
Mm.
The United States is not a democracy and shouldn't be, said Michael Munger, Duke University, a political science department chairman and a 2008 Libertarian gubernatorial candidate, attacking it as a League of Women Voters forum. There is no moral force in the majority. It is just what most people happen to think. These right-wingers are truly worried that a plan reforming the way the president electing Electoral College works is gaining legal ground and could bring the biggest change in the political landscape in decades. The National Popular Vote plan would replace the current system in which states award Electoral College delegates to whomever wins the presidential vote in that state, with a new interstate agreement where participating states' delegates would be bound to the national popular vote winner. In other words, as soon as states with a total of 270 Electoral College delegates sign on and presidential election, Florida in 2000 would be no more. It is born from a frustration of a system that is inherently broken, a system that allots two-thirds to three-fourths of resources in a presidential campaign in the last 6 or 7 weeks to six states. That isn't democracy, said Pam Wilmot, the Common Cause National Popular Vote Coordinator. We cannot and should not have a small number of states deciding the outcome of presidential elections for the rest of us.
The idea that voters across the country, not just in politically split battleground states, would elect the president scares the Republican Party and arch conservatives on so many levels. It would upend the way candidates and political parties and consultants now work to retain their power and influence. It would force presidential nominees and parties to campaign in more racially diverse states, more cities and suburbs, addressing those communities and their concerns. We would need to kill it in the cradle before it grows up, McConnell told a Heritage Foundation audience last December. Right-wingers say these changes are terrible, and not just because they might empower Democrats and relegate the GOP as it now exists to history's dustbin, but even worse, they say, this is a constitutional coup because the founders' great insight was that some branches of government, such as the presidency and the Senate, had to be set apart from the passions of majority opinions and the tyranny of mob rule. It is completely faulty intellectual argument, said MPV founder Stanford University's John Koza. It is oblivious to the fact that mob rules now. In the first presidential election, only five states let people vote for president. And many of the founders, like Alexander Hamilton in New York, were very happy that the people did not vote for president, but it was left up to the states if people voted for president, and now 100% of the states let people vote for president.
So the whole thing has changed, and it's all different now, you know, and plus you have a much different electorate.
Yeah.
And so, you know, based on those grounds, kind of ridiculous. We got Larry Dorman coming up from the AFSCME Union Council 4. I think it's important we should probably read this quick article. I got this from the Council 4 newsletter, AFL-CIO blog. And hang on one second, we'll just read it. The privatization of public services state by state.
Donald Cohen, founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, a National Resource Center on Privatization and Responsible Contracting, sends us this. It seems that there's no public service or piece of property that the private companies are not eyeing as potential revenue streams. While funding anti-government think tanks like American Legislative Exchange Council, companies like Corrections Corporations of America, Waste Management, Maximus, Intuit, Laidlaw, Northrop Grumman, Coke Companies, and Macquarie Capital Advisors, Pinnacle West, and United Healthcare are hoping to use government as their candy store. They want to take over our roads, bridges, parking lots, water systems, college dorms, and prisons. They want to deliver public services like transit systems, school cafeterias, trash and recycling, pickup, mental health services, and many others. The following is a quick scan of just some of the proposals. In water, the emergency manager of Flint, Michigan, is considering selling off its water and sewer systems to the highest bidder. These systems are currently generating revenue for the city. Isn't that ridiculous? Long Island Nassau's county executive, Edward Mangiano's proposal is proposing to privatize the country's sewage treatment system. Mangiano also announced the privatization of Long Island Bus Company to Veolia Transportation. Schools. School districts across the country are planning to contract out custodial, clerical, cafeteria, and bus services. In Michigan, home to the right-wing privatization think tank, the Mechanics Center, lots of school districts are moving forward with plans including Muskegon Heights, West Branch, blah, blah, blah. The real estate industry is seeing potential profits from the growth in charter schools once in.
Okay. The other is prisons and
liquor.
And liquor. is push hard to take control of the state systems that now generate funds for gas.
Like in New Hampshire.
Yeah, New Hampshire, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk to Larry about this.
They figure that's a cash cow. Like, our water company was privatized here in Connecticut.
Yeah, and they've been ripping us off ever since.
Yeah, it's expensive.
It's ridiculous.
I wouldn't advise it, folks. Don't go for it.
No. So, hang on one second.
Leo's going to call Larry. Yeah, we have a private water company, and many of the municipalities went for it here in Connecticut.
And I don't know why.
I don't know why either.
It was payoff time, you know?
Yeah, and they convinced a lot of towns to go for it. And now they have, God only knows who owns the water company. I send my bill to some place in Maine. And I don't even know that if that's where the head of the water company is.
Yeah.
You know,
Lewis, used to be in Maine or something.
Yeah, it used to be in New Haven. That...
Hello?
Hi, Larry. It's Lila. How are you tonight?
Hey, Lila. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Hey,
Leo.
Welcome
to the show.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. We just read to our listeners the article that you had on privatization, how so much is going on with water and schools and prisons and
infrastructure and everything. You
name it. They're trying to get it sold off to private companies so that they can jack up their revenues.
If it's not nailed down, they want to sell it off.
Yeah, isn't it?
It's goods and services, and by the way, it could be instructional aids, you know, it can be human capital, too.
I had read an article a few years ago about hiring teachers from overseas cheaply, I know that that's something that they wanted to do, and that would destroy the union.
And corporatizing the workforce in prisons right now. I mean, they're using prison labor for American corporations.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Right, to have cheap labor and, little known privatization venture that's also happening, that's happened in this country, has been the use of eligibility and benefit workers. For example, our social service workers here in Connecticut, but New York City and other places have tried to use have call centers in India.
Oh, in like India or someplace?
Yeah.
Really?
So if you're you need to get home heating aid or help with food or whatever you can be. So, the point is, obviously, that as the article in Salon pointed out, the idea of the concept of government is becoming how to do things with less and less and less. Regard for consequence.
About 3 years ago, I recall, probably at least 3 years ago, when Schwarzenegger was the governor in California, California DMV, believe it or not, was outsourced to Mexico. A Mexico company was handling the calls and the paperwork.
Yeah, that's
right. Imagine that. I couldn't believe it when I read that. It was
They wonder why we don't have any jobs here.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly the point.
Scratch your head. Why don't you have any jobs? Well, you're outsourcing just about everything and selling everything off.
And even now, tax companies like H&R Block and all these companies are outsourcing their outsourcing tax work to India as well.
Yep. And of course, private companies have been doing this for many years, insurance companies have claims handling done offshore, obviously computer companies.
Our unions really have an uphill battle, don't they, Larry?
Yeah, we do. It's really distressing. You just hit the nail on the head as eloquently as anyone. You wonder why there aren't any jobs. People aren't gainfully employed. They're not paying taxes. They're not buying goods and products and services in their communities.
Here's something. Here's something
breaking
that,
down.
caught me. This was last week. I was watching the show. I don't know if you've seen it on the air. It's a new show. It's called The Shark Tank.
I've read about it. I haven't seen it. Yeah, yep.
It is ridiculous. I tell you, you got three mega millionaires. Okay.
Yeah.
Different ones, I guess, every week. I'm not sure, but there's three of them. One was this guy Cuban who owns the Mavericks and a huge, you know, he's a billionaire, and you got a couple others. But they sit there. There's three of them. And there's a panel, and then you got these investors or these guys who want money, you know, to start up a job, you know, start up a project, right? The first thing, every one of them that came up, you know, had an idea. Okay, to manufacture something. One guy definitely wanted to create the jobs in Georgia and so on and so on and so forth. Well, you know what? None of the investors on the panel, they all refused. They all said, I'm not going to invest in this. That's ridiculous. I can't. And the reason they wouldn't invest in it is because he refused to outsource the jobs. He wanted to create the jobs, this factory in Georgia. All right?
Right.
They said no. They said no. We can't because their profit margin is too thin. If we do that, we have to recreate this and that. But they did this in all three cases, pushing the outsourcing of manufacturing of whatever the project was to China. All right? Can you imagine this? These are Americans.
We've been living it. I mean, that's.
I know, but the thing
well,
was.
Well, they're pushing it on mainstream media so people can see how wonderful
exactly.
it is.
Exactly. And it's like they're saying it's absurd to try to create this in the United States. You have to pay too much wages, blah, blah, blah. We have to go overseas.
Well, they're trying
I was
to
absolutely floored
well,
by,
they're trying
by
to,
the
they're trying to legitimize what they're doing.
It was obvious. But the thing
they're
was is that, you know, anybody watching this. You know, we throw a grenade at those guys. You know what I mean? It's horrifying to think how easily they would dismiss American labor. You know,
right? And for the simple reason that the costs are a little bit higher, meaning you know the executive profits will be a little lower. Gotten away from the fundamentals in this country. We've gotten away from the social contract that workers would be. Rewarded modestly for their productivity and that they could participate fully in the economy and in our society. And, you know, consequences are just frightening. I can't get over that. I mean,
it's all greed. I mean, it's totally dominated by greed.
Well, you're right. I mean, this is about what makes this even more frightening is the fact that, you know, you got a generation or two of young people who, you know, absent exposure to unions and other forces for social good are growing up to believe that there's no hope, that it is too expensive to have jobs here. And so, you know, they're almost resigned to the fact that there won't be jobs, there won't be manufacturing jobs. And, I want to loop it back to what you said at the beginning about privatization because, you know, one of the good things about civil service is that it has always been, you know, public employment. State,
mm-hmm.
local, federal government have always been places where women, people of color can get work. It really was and could still be a bastion for the middle class. Getting government jobs was kind of your foothold for so many people. Into the middle class. So as we privatize and, you know, practice the same mentality that you see in the Shark Tank, what happens is, where are you going to hire the custodians? Where are you going to hire the secretaries? You know, where are you going to hire the paraprofessionals? Because, you know, we're breeding more hopelessness, more despair, and we don't have people who can make a gainful living. So it's all very sad.
Well, here's another thing that I read just last week that states are doing this now. States are outsourcing work they're outsourcing work, infrastructure work they're bidding, they're putting up these bids or construction, like on bridges and on roads and stuff like that, right? And they're putting them up to for bid, and Chinese companies have bid on these contracts.
Oh yeah, yep.
Have bought, and the states have actually granted them the contracts. Now, guess what? They don't have to. They're not hiring American workers. They're importing Chinese workers to work on these projects.
Right. They stay.
They can pay them nothing.
They stay in like flop houses and cheap hotels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's. I mean, and the states are allowing this because they're getting a deal. All right.
But
I mean,
not,
what?
You know,
I mean, this is preposterous. I believe this was, Minnesota.
Sounds about right, doesn't it?
And,
I've got an example that's going to be even more disturbing to you. I read on a website that actually Chinese labor and materials were used on the newly christened memorial for Martin Luther King.
Oh, yes, that was made in China.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it was made in China.
I think it was
a foreign sculptor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they did the quote wrong.
Yeah.
Yep. They did the quote wrong, and then apparently they had workers staying in these cheap motels, Chinese workers staying in these cheap motels and flop houses, you know, in Virginia and around D.C. So
I found that very insulting.
And it was
Dr. King would have found it insulting.
Yeah, it was commissioned by the foundation, I think, the Martin Luther King Foundation.
Yeah, and they said they had no choice or they didn't realize what they were doing, but people know what they're doing. Everybody, you know, these guys are all cognizant of, you know, the decisions.
Jeez.
They don't give a damn.
It's ridiculous. We've lost it, Larry. I mean, we're losing it.
We are. You guys know that we've had this prolonged fight in New Haven to stop the privatization of our school custodians. And, you know, we had a partial victory through the arbitration process where we kept the union intact but lost quite a few of the members who are either unemployed or going to come back in, you know, part-time, low-wage employment. But the president of the bargaining unit, is a wonderful guy, Rob Monturi, and you know, he says, you know, he takes great pride. He cleans the bathrooms like they're his own. He cleans the hallways like it's his own home. And you know, Rob has always said to me, and he's testified at the Board of Education and, you know, the New Haven Alderman, that where do kids go? You know, he said not everybody gets a college education. A lot of kids graduate high school or get their GED, and that's as high as they're going to go. In terms of the academic food chain, so
Now there's student loans.
They deserve jobs. They deserve jobs too. And you know, Rob's point simply has been that, you know, there's nothing wrong. It's a good job to become a city custodian, a school custodian. You get a decent wage. You get health care. And again, you know, you're able to put money down on a house or an apartment. You're able to kind of live a little bit of the American dream. And he said, you know, there've got to be jobs for people who don't go to college and don't get PhDs. And, you know,
well, the sad part is that they're now not even jobs for kids who've graduated from college. You know,
exactly.
You know, we have kids who've, you know, gone to our local elementary school, gone off to college. They're back living at home because they can't find jobs. So they they take a job, you know, managing at McDonald's besides someone who got a GED from high school.
Yeah, there was the AFL-CIO had a young union workers panel discussion at the Hartford Public Library last week, and it was good. And there were quite a few non-union folks in the audience, and this young man spoke up. He was about 27, and he was speaking during the Q&A, and he said, he didn't want to say where he worked, but he said, I just never imagined that, you know, 5 years after I graduated, I'd still be working in a service sector job, and I guess my parents didn't imagine that either. You know, and it hasn't been through lack of effort. There's just not a whole lot out there, and all we're doing is we're pitting people against each other for, you know, to try to get one low-wage job and pitting that against another. And that's what's going on.
Yeah, this a friend of mine, her son... was very close friends with a boy who graduated valedictorian of his class, got full scholarship to Columbia, and he's working at Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, we loop back to that discussion in the beginning, you know. Maybe he could be an engineer for a municipality. Maybe
right.
He could be a paraprofessional. Maybe he could be a teacher. You know, maybe he could be a public works employee. But, you know, those jobs aren't there. Those were the jobs that provided some entree into the middle class. And, you know, they're gone.
That's sure.
And, you know,
yeah, we're really having tough times. And then you read something like this. Representative Carter condemns state employees for the veterans' financial woes after they've given $1.6 billion in concessions to Malloy.
Right. You know, that's the drumbeat. It's coming out of the Republican playbook. You're seeing it during the laughable debates that have been taking place, which I think is just a comedy show.
But isn't that awful?
It's dark comedy. You know, it's black comedy. It's tragedy. But, you know, that's what's going on is that, you know, we have politicians blaming workers who actually have a toehold in the middle class. And, you know, rather than figure out how are we going to expand retirement security to people who don't have it, let's take it away from people who do. And, you know, we're on that track, that dialogue track, we're not going to be too pleased with the outcome.
And, it turned out that the job growth for this last quarter, or month, I should say.
That they tout,
the 243,000 jobs or something. Turns out that the majority of those are part-time and low-wage jobs.
Exactly. They're
majority, almost the whole lot of them. All right.
There are a lot of service sector jobs where people hire during the
holiday. And part-time work and part-time jobs. The people going, you know, running out of unemployment and taking part-time jobs, you know.
Yeah, and I think the Obama folks and, you know, the Democrats should be careful. They shouldn't crow too much about that jobs report because we're still, you know, I think we're still very much up the creek without a paddle here.
Oh, yeah.
And what makes me laugh is that, you know, when Bush was in office and they saw, you know, a 200,000 job thing, they were criticizing it all over. Oh, what's 200,000 jobs? You know what I mean? Or what's 1,000? You know, what's this? And yet, you know, the media is applauding 150,000 jobs in 1 month, you know?
In some ways, you know, it's almost as if Obama and the Democrats prevail in November, which certainly I'd like to see, it's really going to be by default because the other party is so bereft of any.
It's so horrible. You know,
you're
saw
right.
Something.
I mean, this jobs report, as soon as I saw it, I thought to myself, this isn't such good news because you had to look deeper into what kind of jobs are being created.
Right.
You know, and at the same time, you know, the joblessness numbers are affected by the fact that people's benefits expire and they haven't found work. So what's happening to them? You know, they've given up the job search. So, you know, we're still very much in a deep hole.
We really are. How about that compromise with the Senate and the House Republicans on the Federal Aviation Administration Revitalization Bill? What did you think about that?
I guess you won't be surprised that I thought that it's geared to prevent the very activity that will help lift people up, which is union organizing.
I was disgusted with that.
In a strange way, it reminded me of the debate about the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act. I should say the Homeland Security Act after the 9/11 Twin Towers attack, because the Bush administration and the Republicans in charge exempted collective bargaining, took away collective bargaining rights, for example, from Border Patrol agents, which, and when in fact those agents would tell you that having a union was very important to the quality, to the training they got, to the fact that they couldn't be subjected to political games, doing the sensitive work that they did. And, you know, this kind of just brought back that bad memory for me, because if you're crafting a compromise that's designed to, again, you know, keep the work level at lower pay and benefits and without rights, you know, then you're just opening up the door for bad things, not just for the workers, but for the service they provide. And
no, I mean, you know, it makes me laugh when I hear that these Republicans, condemning this class warfare. You know, oh, the Democrats are trying to promote class warfare. The liberals are.
Well, I think
they're
exactly right. It is class warfare.
It is totally
them against everybody else.
It is class warfare, for crying out loud. I mean, it's like, you know. I mean, what else can it be? What else is it? You know?
What else is it? And I think, but, you know, quite honestly, it's people like you who are raising the issue that, you know, to me have validity. I wish, you know, I could say that the Democrats, you know, and look, there are a lot of good ones out there, but, you know, look, as a party, they're probably as beholden to Wall Street.
I mean,
I think we just, all of us who really care about this, sort of have to forge our own independent way in terms of advocating for the 99%, because I just don't really trust.
Well, look at this. Soros stated in an interview that Obama and Romney are one and the same, okay? But he said that they're the same. He says their backers are the same, their policies are virtually the same. He says there's no difference. He says the only person that would be of any change, all right, would be Ron Paul. He says, and he thought that Newt Gingrich might be of change as well, but he didn't think that Gingrich's change would be welcomed. But
I think Gingrich is a fraudulent gas bag.
Oh, isn't he awful?
He makes you sick, doesn't he?
He was lobbying for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and, you know, helping perpetrate that. But, you know, look, I think Mitt Romney and Obama are one and the same? No, I think Obama does have some, you know, progressive beliefs, and that he tried to put some of that into action, whereas I don't think Romney really has any core beliefs.
He's just a puppet
of the very wealthy. But you know, again, the stranglehold that Wall Street and the corporations have on both parties, the stranglehold on the Supreme Court that gave us that ludicrous Citizens United decision, which is going to be harmful for many years to come, just kind of is all proof that we're going to have to forge. That we're going to need some kind of independent way out of this thing. That's all.
Well, with AFSCME is going to be supporting Obama.
Yeah, AFSCME has endorsed Obama.
Yep.
And
I hope they hold his feet to the fire and demand
something. Yep, Myla, that's it. That's what we can do and should do, because obviously the alternative is worse.
Well, yeah. you know what Ralph Nader said. I was going to, tonight, toward the end of the show, I've got a short interview with him that they did on
Democracy Now, I think it was from.
And he said that, and he was talking about this, he wrote a new book. It's called How to Get Esteemed at the Corporations or something like that.
Yeah.
And he said the Republicans. Right now, he says this whole thing is a joke. But he says the Democrats, he says that the liberal establishment, he said, if you will, he's really pissed off at them, because he sees that there's this void of silence. He says, and pressure that they're applying to Obama. He says they're not applying anything, because right now they're so frightened by the concept of any of these Republican candidates getting in office. All right. And they haven't put up any popular any populist candidate, you know. And he says Obama hasn't even embraced the Occupy Wall Street movement. He says, nor has he, you know, he's doing nothing. that the liberals demand that he do.
He certainly has exceeded
Warren. Or that he was elected for. He says he talks a big game and does absolutely nothing. This was Nader's criticism. I agree with him 100%.
I don't want to just single out the president. I mean, the fact is that, you know, the Democratic Party hasn't really embraced the Occupy.
No, not at all. And not only that, but what Nader is saying, he says, is that the Democrats have not, stepped up to the plate here, you know. And he said but the problem is, he says, that the liberal establishment is not going, has not pushed him enough, all right, to do it. And then he said, which I was very shocked that he said this. He says the only way that you can make a statement in this election is by not voting.
Yeah.
And he says and he advocated not voting in this election. I was really surprised that he said that, but at the same time, what he said is exactly how what I've been feeling for this last year. You know, is that I cannot support Obama in anything that he's been doing. I cannot support any kind of Republican, and tonight I just read an article where, you know, where I thought I was excited a bit about Ron Paul to some degree. Turns out now this guy wants to
sell off federal lands.
What he wants to do is he wants to abolish the Department of Interior,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to give all the federal lands back to the states. And the states can do whatever they want with
and
it. Sell them out.
And the states, of course, will sell out the best part of the federal.
The states will sell out their own Capitol building. They might as well,
Actually, like almost like a hearkening back to the Civil War type.
Exactly. I mean,
look, we're in a rough position, and I
stuff this guy's
I
been
understand
saying.
Your frustration. You
know, he gets more popular, and then all of a sudden he starts talking, crazy shit. Like, let's get rid of the Department of Interior and let's abolish all federal land holdings. I mean, that means all the parks and all the national parks.
And the reason we had that as a federal agency is so that things stay secure for the people.
Exactly.
Right.
They were established
a wonderful thing, I think.
Well, you know, again, everything is this sort of endlessly negative, vicious cycle. From we talked about at the beginning of the segment, you sell off assets, you never regain that infrastructure, that ability to provide the services.
Yeah.
You know, as the public employer, you're losing revenue, people aren't working, so you become more desperate. So when you're done, cutting and slicing the public workforce and cutting and slicing and dicing the services, you got nothing left. And
the governor of Idaho last year sold something like 500,000 acres to China,
mm-hmm.
all right, of land, and he sold it for China because China wanted to build their own city there.
Right.
That's
crazy. That's it. You know, we're selling to foreign countries. We're selling to...
500,000 acres of land, all right, to...
we haven't heard anything more about that.
Well, they covered that up. I mean, after that article, I mean, once that hit the once people realized what was going on, I think they stopped that.
Yeah.
But it's still... I mean, can you imagine selling part of your state to China? So that they could build their own city?
To anything. But again, that's what's happening.
Right, they're going to bring in million Chinese. Yeah, how are they going to do that?
I hope we can do some things to stop some of this stuff, but I don't know exactly what it is. But we certainly need to get behind AFSCME and the unions and your guys' initiative.
Oh,
we hope we can create some change.
Good.
Hope you. Yeah, I
you have a real uphill battle there, Larry, and I know how hard you work.
We all do, but you know what? You're doing great work just by speaking truth to power, and we're going to keep forging ahead. We're going to keep pushing, so no need to worry on our end.
We need all the help we can get. We all need to be in together. We have to remember that there are more of us than there are of them, and people
exactly.
have to remember their own personal power.
Yep, I agree with you.
Well, thanks so much for being with
Thank
us tonight, Larry.
Larry.
And we really appreciate the time you give us.
Good. Let's talk soon.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Right. Have a good night, guys. See you.
And that was Larry Dorman with the SV Union. And we appreciate his being with us.
And so let's go to some Woody in the Ring music right down here.
Yes.
Right here. Into the ring with
Woody. Thank you, Lyra. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, of course, we'll talk about this past weekend, the big game, the Super Bowl, a little bit of basketball talk, and maybe a little bit of baseball, but let's get right down to it. As I predicted, of course, and I had my hot hand when it came to picking games throughout the playoffs, the New York Football Giants handled their business at the Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis this past Sunday. They, of course, defeated the much-hated New England Patriots. Where to start? Well, from the beginning of the game, it certainly appeared like the Giants really were just moving the ball at will. The Patriots defense, as I said all along, is very soft. But I tell you what they did do. They took away the long pass play. But you have to tip your cap to Eli Manning because he took everything else that they gave him. They surely took away the 30, 40, 50-yard bomb passes, which ended up turning into touchdowns with the speedy Giants receivers. But instead, he had to take the underneath stuff, 10 to 20-yard stuff. But you know what? You just keep doing 10 yards, 20 yards, 10 yards, 20 yards. I mean, you move down the field, but what happens is you end up eating up the clock. And the Giants had the ball for 15 minutes longer than the Patriots. And, they played a little bit of ball control. Now, granted, the Giants did stumble a few times with some penalties and some untimely sacks. But to me, it really seemed like the Giants could just move the ball whenever they wanted to. They were just moving the ball. They 6 yards, 10 yards, boom, they were just making it happen. They put a decent little running game together. And to me, in this game, there was a few plays which really, made the game turn one way or another, And I think for the Patriots, there were some plays that just absolutely killed them. In the fourth quarter, there was a pass to their wide receiver, Branch, who had a garbage game, as I predicted, because he's pretty much a has-been. Now, granted, Brady threw the pass, and it was definitely a little bit behind Branch. But had Branch caught it, he was running to his left, and the closest D-back was 15 yards away from him, and the D-back was running to his right. So they were, both running in opposite directions, and if Branch had caught that ball, they certainly would have been way down into Giant territory, and the clock would have just ticked away. But instead, he dropped it. Another big play, of course, which I'm sure, Wes Welker will be running in his head from now until the next season starts, was the pass that he missed, where he turned around and catch the ball. Now, Brady definitely underthrew the ball. However, as a receiver, if you get both hands on a ball, the rule is you're supposed to catch it for the most part. Now, as I said, the ball was a bit underthrown. Welker did miss time his turn and spin the catch. And, you know, that one against the Patriots. Another big play to, that the Patriots failed to make was when Brady threw a bomb to Gronkowski, and one of the Giants just sniffed up and intercepted the ball and put it into a, you know, put it into a drive. Now, for the Giants, you know, there was a penalty on their tackle Booth. I guess he held one of the Patriot linemen, and that really ended a big drive. He held Vince Wilfork, who, by the way, that was the only time during the entire game that his name was called. And they were talking about, oh, Vince Wilfork's going to have a monster game, yada, 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 yada. Well, he didn't do anything, and the Giants definitely neutralized him. So you never heard anything from him. However, except that one time when he was held in the end of the drive. And then there was a couple of sacks that were gigantic that stopped the Giants from scoring, you know. And I must say this. When the Patriots scored that touchdown, you know, before the half, they were really moving the ball nicely. And then they came out in the second half, and they marched right down the field again. You know, I was saying that if the Giants' offense doesn't, you know, pick up the Giant defense and, you know, do something here, they got big trouble because it looked like, you know, the Patriots were moving at will. You know, Brady just looked unstoppable. It looked like he was on a mission there. But the Giants crawled back in. They got a couple of field goals, and then, you know, things just didn't go the way the Patriots, you know, planned, you know. And Eli Manning got that 88-yard drive, and then they only left, you know, the Patriots with 57 seconds, and they had a minute to score. You know, they had to get it down there to score 57 seconds, you know, and they had to go 80 yards to score. And that's just very difficult in the NFL, even if you are Tom Brady. Belichick made the mistake, though. There should have been more time on the clock. Had Belichick allowed the Giants to score an easy touchdown, as it was, they allowed Bradshaw to run that ball in, and then Bradshaw kind of like stopped and he sat down, and then his momentum carried him into the end zone. Well, they should have let the Giants score on the play previous to that, because it would have, you know, given them an additional 40 seconds. Now, for people that watch the game, you saw how, you know, many yards the Patriots got. They got almost, you know, to the 50-yard line, and then Brady was forced to throw two Hail Marys. You know, with an additional 45 seconds, you figure maybe, you know, the Patriots and Brady, you know, get to the 30-yard line of the Giants, or the 25 or the 20, and then it's a whole different ballgame when you're, you know, when you got four downs and you're throwing the ball into the end zone every time. You know, anything can happen, and by anything, you know, the Patriots could score a touchdown. The Giants could get an interception, you know. But, you know, your chances of scoring a touchdown are certainly greater if you're throwing the ball from, the say, you know, anywhere between the 30-yard line and the 20-yard line as opposed to your own 45-yard line. You know, the distance is just, you know, a great deal less. And, you know, your chances, you know, obviously are multiplied because, you know, it's an easier pass to make. But, you know, so that's a big mistake by Belichick. Now, when I was watching the game, admittedly, I certainly wasn't thinking of the old, hey, let them score trick so you have time, you know, to, you know, try and get your score on. I totally didn't cross my mind. I totally spaced it, so I feel kind of stupid. I should know my sports better than that. But, you know, in hindsight, you know, at least I figured out that they should have done it to play before. And in, speaking of hindsight, interestingly, after the game, Tom Brady's model wife, Giselle, the Victoria's Secret model, in hindsight, maybe she should have kept her phone in her mouth shut. She was kind of getting razzed as she was getting into some secret, you know, elevator passageway or whatever, Lucas Oil Stadium. One of the Giants fans had said to her, Eli Manning, you know, Eli owns your husband or something like that. And she turned around with a foul mouth, fury to her face, to face her tormentors. And she certainly didn't, you know, blame her husband. She cursed these people. And then, you know, instead she blamed Brady's teammates, who she didn't mention by name, for failing to catch the ball. Mostly she was really pissed that they made Tommy look bad. She said, and I quote, You need to catch the ball when you're supposed to catch the ball, she railed. My husband cannot fucking throw the ball and catch the ball at the same time. I can't believe they dropped the ball so many times. Oof. That's
brutal.
She was
absolutely right, Pete. I'm sorry. I think she was absolutely right on that.
Well, she had a point, but you're supposed to keep that in the locker room.
Yeah.
You don't ever do anything in the media to make your teammates look bad. Ever.
Yeah. About that.
And by the way, she's not a teammate. She's a fucking wife and should know her place. And her place is to shut up and sit in the luxury box and watch the game and not make comments on the game afterwards. That's her place.
Well, that's probably... Oh. Yeah, she sure threw his teammates under the bus, didn't she, huh?
Yeah, you don't do that. You just don't do that. And I can guarantee you he probably got into it with her on the way home. I guarantee that was a fight. Because you just don't do that.
Right.
You don't do that to your teammates, and you certainly don't do it to your husband's teammates.
And not publicly.
No, certainly not publicly. Certainly not publicly. And believe me, those guys that drop the balls, they know they drop the balls. There's no need to make it any worse. They just lost the Super Bowl. Believe me, these guys are not really happy. You know, they're all competitors, you know. I'm sure a lot of these guys, you know, are the kind of guys that certainly wouldn't let their kids beat them in anything. You know, you guys are real competitors. And, you know, for someone's wife to make a comment like that, it's just absolutely ludicrous and disrespectful.
Yeah, I agree.
Moving on a little bit. Speaking of ludicrous, there were inductees into the Football Hall of Fame this past weekend, and Bill Parcells was not inducted into the Hall of Fame, which I find that preposterous. Bill Parcells, we're talking about two Super Bowl champion teams. When he coached the New York Football Giants, his coaching tree, the guys that have coached under him, you know, two of the guys, well, they coached the football teams this weekend and played in the Super Bowl. Tom Coughlin and Bill Belichick are both Bill Parcells' proteges, and there's many others throughout the league. Now, Parcells went from the Giants to the Patriots, where he made the Patriots relevant again. Let me tell you something. Before Bill Parcells went to the Patriots were the joke of the league for quite some time, you know? And then Parcells got Bledsoe and so on and so forth. And, you know, Parcells made the Patriots relevant again. Then he went to the Jets organization and did the same thing. Or maybe it was the other way. He might have went from the Jets to the Patriots. But either way, he made both of those organizations relevant again. Then I believe he went to Dallas, where he finally got down in the playoffs for the first time in years. And currently he's in Miami, where he's done a lot of positive stuff down there, too. And I just find it unbelievable that he, you know, they didn't put him in the Hall of Fame. Now, the funny thing about the Hall of Fame is, unlike the Baseball Hall of Fame, where the reporters have to, you know, reveal who they voted for, the Football Hall of Fame doesn't allow you to reveal who you voted for. So if you have some kind of vendetta against, you know, Bill Parcells, you know, for maybe leaving your New England Patriots or leaving, you know, your New York Jets or leaving your New York Giants, you know, you cannot vote him in just strictly out of a personal issue. And you can't be called on it because they don't allow you to say who you voted for. So the whole process to get into the Hall of Fame in football, I think, is really piss poor. And some adjustments definitely need to be made. I just found that kind of interesting. A little bit of basketball news. Larry Bird said that he would much rather, if he had his druthers, he would take Kobe Bryant over LeBron James. And I thought that was very telling. I personally agree with him. I think to me it says that the old school guys don't like the way LeBron plays or just don't like LeBron, period. Because, you know, you hear other rumblings, you know. A lot of people think he was kind of cowardly for leaving the Cleveland organization and going to like a ready-made, you know, supposedly ready-made championship team down there in Miami, where he goes, you know, he was the head honcho in Cleveland, you know, the Cleveland, it was his team. And when you're a superstar, then you go to another team and you, and it's not your team and you're deferring to the other guy. I mean, you're supposed to, you know, according to you, you're the best guy in the NBA, and yet you're going to another team, another superstar's team, and now you're deferring to him. I don't know. I just find it really, I don't know, kind of cowardly. I just, doesn't seem to have much sand in his shoes, you know. He's, you know. But, so that was, you know, that was very interesting. But, you know, the Super Bowl was great. The ratings were extremely high. And, you know, as far as the Patriots go, you know, obviously I'm quite glad they lost, you know. And, you know, Tom Brady a lot of times does, you know, something with, you know, with nothing. As I had mentioned prior to the game, Gronkowski had a high ankle sprain, would be absolutely worthless. He would only be used as a decoy, and he wouldn't be able to do anything great. And, you know, that was exactly the case. As I said, high ankle sprains are a major ordeal. If Gronkowski had played, do I think it would have made a difference in the game? I think it might have made a difference in the game. I mean, the culture was already pretty close as it was, but, hey, you know, you never know with these things. And, you know, like I said, I think the right team won the Super Bowl. They held the ball for 15 minutes more than New England did. So, I mean, when you do that, you should win the game. Another thing that's been going on, I'm just drifting back to football here. A lot of people are arguing over whether Peyton Manning and Eli Manning, who's the better brother. Obviously, Peyton Manning has one Super Bowl victory. And he has a whole shitload of great records, you know, where they won 13 games, 14 games, 12 games. I mean, you know, his regular season record is definitely better than Eli's. You know, his passing yards is definitely better than Eli's. But he's lost a lot of big games, and Eli just doesn't seem like he loses big games. He seems very cool under pressure, almost like nothing bothers him. Nothing gets him too wound up. Nothing gets him too down. He just seems like a very even keel kind of guy, you know, who gets it done in the fourth quarter. And there's just a big debate right now whether, you know, who you would rather have. And, you know, certainly Peyton with an injured neck is definitely an issue. And you know, Eli's younger, and he seems to perform better in the clutch. I thought we would have to go with Eli, but that's just me. If you ask anybody else, they might say something different. As far as Peyton Manning goes, I believe that he has a great chance of going to the Washington Redskins, who have a big checkbook and have no problem writing things out, or he very may well go to the New York Jets. Now, I didn't believe that was to be the case as of a few weeks ago, but Manning came out and said that he will sign an incentive-laden contract. You know, he wants to be paid for his performance, not for what he may or may not be able to do. He knows that people are certainly concerned about this neck injury, you know, whether he's still going to be a good player or not. So I think he's, you know, and plus he has a lot of money as it is. But I think he really wants to play. I think he kind of wants to, you know, saying that he's taking an incentive contract. It's really kind of like a big screw you, Indianapolis, you know, to me. So maybe he wants to go to the Jets, where he can still kind of bang out with Indianapolis and maybe embarrass them. You know, as I said before, these guys are all extremely competitive. Believe me, Manning would love nothing better to win another Super Bowl on another team and kind of stick it to Indianapolis. But, you know, so we'll see where Peyton signs, but he's definitely going to sign somewhere. I mean, I thought he was going to try and possibly go to San Francisco or maybe with Miami, but who knows? You know, your guess is as good as mine. But it's definitely going to be an interesting season next season. It's definitely going to be very interesting. And it was a good NFL season. Unfortunately, my team, my quarterback got an injured Cutler. But the Bears certainly looked a lot better this year. And I definitely look forward to the next football season. So that's going to be great. And next week I'll be able to talk a little baseball because pitchers and catchers are coming back together there in a couple weeks. So, and the next thing you know, we got a little springtime, spring training, baseball and stuff. I think the first game of the spring, like, is in, I don't know, April, March, end of March, something. I don't know. So spring training gets started. Hey, baseball's going to be going here on going on here very soon. So that's going to be some fun. It's always fun to talk a little bit of baseball. So that's it for this week. Shout out to all my wit heads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, my partner Money Mike at the Northeast Athletic Club. That's it for this week. Hopefully winter's on its way out the door. Not that we've had much of one, but well, enjoy it while it lasts. Till next week.
Thank you, Woody, and for his sports segment, and we thank Larry Dorman, who was our guest from Ask Me, and we have about 10 more minutes, and maybe we could play a little bit of Ralph Nader. That would be interesting.
Then we can direct
people to this to listen to the rest of it themselves.
That's good. I think I'll play. This is about a 15-minute interview, and I'd rather... directed. It's a Democracy Now! Interview that was done with Ralph Nader, and he said in his talk, when they asked him about what he thought about about Obama, he says one thing and does another, and that's basically what it is. And that's what he did, and he was talking about the State
Everything.
Of the Union. He doesn't have much faith in the guy.
No, I don't either.
He doesn't have any faith in him. Doesn't have any faith in the system anymore, I don't think either.
Let's hear what he has to say.
Here goes. See
Ralph
if we
Nader.
Can, if we can jazz it up a little bit or speed it up.
Bill here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Went into the military alliance with Israel and did what the American...
President Obama for a second term. What do you think?
Well, I think his lawless militarism that started the speech and ended the speech was truly astonishing.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very committed to projecting the American empire in Obama terms, force projection in the Pacific, and distorting the whole process of how he explains Iraq and Afghanistan. He talks about Libya and Syria and then went into the military alliance with Israel and didn't talk about the peace process or the plight of the Palestinians who are being so repressed. Leaving Iraq as if it was a victory. Iraq has been destroyed. Massive refugees, over 1 million Iraqis dead. Contaminated environment, collapsing infrastructure, sectarian warfare. He should be ashamed of himself that he tries to drape our soldiers who were sent on lawless military missions to kill and die in those countries, unconstitutional wars that violate Geneva Conventions and international law and federal statutes, and drape them as if they've come back from Iwo Jima or Normandy. So I think it was a very, very poor taste to start and end with this kind of massive militarism in the Obama empire.
And on the economy, Ralph Nader, on the economy, your response to what Obama said last night?
Well, a lot of good-sounding words. He's very good at that. I'm glad he focused on Wall Street abuses on more than one occasion. I'm glad that he focused on renewable energy. But notice that he just mentioned climate change but didn't go anywhere on that one. He still is not able to use the word poverty. It's always the middle class, which is shrinking into poverty. But you've got 60, 70, 80 million people living in poverty in the United States and child poverty. And the most amazing gap was his promise in 2008 to press for the raising of the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $9.50 by 2011. So he went for equal pay for equal work for women, but millions of people in this country, one out of every three full-time workers, are earning Walmart wages, many of them not far over the $7.25 raise. Now, the $9.50 minimum wage would still be less in inflation-adjusted terms than it was in 1968. And when worker productivity was half of what it is today. So a lot of his suggestions, like the attitude toward foreign trade, well, he said that in 2008. He wanted to revive NAFTA. He didn't lift a finger. Yeah. So how credible are his words vis-a-vis China, for example, in the trade area and importing hazardous products into this country? How credible are his words? How credible are his words when he says he wants to start a financial crimes unit in the Justice Department? I mean, what does that mean unless he demands a much larger budget for prosecutors and law enforcement officials against the corporate crime wave? Maybe he needs a subscription to the Corporate Crime Reporter to tell him that we've been through these kinds of rhetorics before by prior presidents. They're going to establish an enforcement unit here and there, but without a major budget, it's going to go nowhere.
Let me play President Obama's announcement last night of a new unit devoted to investigating major financial crimes.
We'll also establish a financial crimes unit of highly trained investigators to crack down on large-scale fraud and protect people's investments. Some financial firms violate major anti-fraud laws because there's no real penalty for being a repeat offender. That's bad for consumers, and it's bad for the vast majority of bankers and financial service professionals who do the right thing. So pass legislation that makes the penalties for fraud count. And tonight I'm asking my Attorney General to create a special unit of federal prosecutors and leading state attorney general to expand our investigations into the abuse of lending and packaging of risky mortgages that led to the housing crisis. This new unit will hold accountable those who broke the law, speed assistance to homeowners, and help turn the page on an era of recklessness that hurt so many Americans.
That was President Obama announcing that New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman will head this unit. I'm going back to the to August. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman being kicked off a 50-state task force negotiating a possible settlement with the nation's largest mortgage companies. The move coming just a day after the New York Times reported that the Obama administration was pressuring Schneiderman to agree to a broad state settlement with banks over questionable foreclosure tactics. Ralph Nader, your response.
Well, that's the double standard that he's such an expert at, Obama. He says one thing and does another. Where's he been for over 3 years? He's had the Justice Department. There are existing laws that could prosecute and convict Wall Street crooks. He hasn't sent more than one or two to jail. It is important to strengthen the corporate criminal laws through congressional legislation. But what has he done? This financial crimes unit, that's like putting another label on a few doors in the Justice Department without a real expansion in the budget. But then when he said to the American people, no more bailouts, no more handouts and no more cop-outs. But that's what's been going on, and it's going on today, and it went on last year under his administration. Washington is a bustling bazaar of accounts receivable. They're bailing out and they're handing out all kinds of subsidies to corporations, handouts, giveaways, transfer of technology, transfer of medical research to the drug companies without any reasonable price provisions on drugs, giveaway of natural resources on the federal lands, you name it.
I'm going to. We've got about 1 minute left with our stream, and I just want to say thank you for joining us. I'm going to play the remainder of this on that recorded time, so you can catch it in the archives. But I want to thank Larry Dorman and Pete, and I want to thank and I want to hope you join us tomorrow night, and Thursday and Friday night this week. So. I hope you, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, and I hope we talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And if you can, listen to this on the archives. It's really good.
Just by the last few
So
minutes.
Good night, folks.
It's still going on. As far as a cop-out, how about his deferred prosecution gimmicks with these corporations under the Justice Department, where they never have to plead guilty. They never have to make themselves vulnerable to civil civil lawsuits so they pay back the American people what they've stolen from them. So obviously, State of the Union speeches are full of rhetoric, they're full of promises, but it's good to measure them against the past performance of the Obama administration and what his promises were in 2008. They don't really stand up very well.
Ralph Nader, I want to turn to the Republican response to the State of the Union address. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, a former budget director under President George W. Bush, delivered the response to his address, to Obama's address. He slammed Obama for halting the Keystone XL pipeline project that would transport oil from Canada to Texas, equating the move to a, quote, pro-poverty policy.
The extremism that stifles the development of homegrown energy or cancels a perfectly safe pipeline that would employ tens of thousands, or jacks up consumer utility bills for no improvement in either human health or world temperature, is a pro-poverty policy. It must be replaced by a passionate pro-growth approach that breaks all ties and calls all close ones in favor of private sector jobs that restore opportunity for all and generate the public revenues to pay our bills.
Ralph Nader, your response.
Well, first of all, the XL pipeline is basically shipping very dirty Albertan oil down through the United States over very, very sensitive aquifers and other environmental conditions down to the Gulf in order to ship it abroad. That's the big farce of this pipeline project. It's not going to be brought to make this country more reliant on Canada instead of the Middle East. It's basically an export pipeline. And the second is, Mitch Daniels would have done the public a great service in his speech if he would have urged the corporations in this country who are sitting on $2 trillion of cash, like Cisco and Apple and Google, to start giving some of that cash back to shareholders in terms of dividends and to pension funds and mutual funds, which would increase consumer demand and create more jobs, just the way a minimum wage increase would increase consumer demand to create more jobs. Instead, he didn't say that, and Obama has constantly restricted any kind of stimulus to tax breaks, to tax incentives, to tax reductions, which, of course, will not do much to build up the government's resources for a major job-producing public works program in every community, good-paying jobs, repairing America, schools, bridges, public transit, drinking water systems, jobs that cannot be exported abroad. So we need to develop a very concrete critique of these politicians' statements up against what they could do if they had the courage of their office. Imagine Obama never mentioning the Occupy movement. Imagine Obama never mentioning the Occupy Wall Street movement, the main citizen awareness movement, to be coupled with his alleged concern with Wall Street abuses. And yet he talks about advancing human dignity for all people abroad, and he never talks about a major human dignity initiative, the Occupy initiative, based on peaceful resistance to oligarchy and plutocracy. He's a political coward. He's got to repair back to the Oval Office and ask himself why he can't stand for the people in this country who are really aware and trying to improve our democracy and advance justice and make government and corporations accountable.
Ralph, you have written a new book called Getting Steam to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. People may be listening to you right now and agreeing with what a lot of you are saying and also saying, what is the alternative here? Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, what is your response to that?
Well, this is the book, and I'm going to drop it off at the White House soon. I think he should read it, because the left is not making any demands on Obama, because they're so freaked out by the Republicans and their crazed rhetoric on their debates. Well, if that is going to continue for 2012, that means the corporations are pulling on Obama and the Democratic Party. The Republicans are pulling on Obama and Democratic Party because they're getting all the media because they have a vibrant primary process and there's no primary challenge to Obama. So the progressive agenda is not getting any media at all week after week. So the alternative, Amy, is for the left, such as they are, progressive, liberal people, I like to call them justice seekers, to make demands on Obama, to make demands for improving the rights of labor, improving the rights of small farmers, improving the rights of small business, the environmental demands that need to be made, the crackdown on corporate crime, a whole panoply of corporate reform agenda, the kind of crackdown on these global corporations that abandoned America and shipped jobs and industries to fascist and communist regimes who know how to keep workers in their place. But there is no pull because they're so freaked out by the Republicans. So one can really say the Republicans could sit around in a smoke-filled room and say, let's be even more crazed, let's be even more corporatist. This will create a good vacuum for the Democrats to move into because both parties are dialing for the same corporate dollars, and it'll bring the left to their knees because they'll say, we got nowhere to go. Well, the reason why this speech was so failing, especially in foreign and military policy, the reason why it was so failing is because Obama doesn't have to worry about tens of millions of people who call themselves progressives or liberals because they have signaled to him that they got nowhere to go. Well, I think if they believe they got nowhere to go, that they don't want to vote for a third party or a Green Party, they can at least in April, May, June hold his feet to the fire and present him with a set of progressive demands in order to tell him that they do have a place to go. They can stay home. And that's what hurt the Democrats in 2010. People can just stay home.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you for being with us. His book is called Getting Steam to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we go to...
Okay, I want to thank that was that. You can check that out on democracynow.org. You may have that interview. It's also on YouTube.
Very good.
So,
he always manages to come right to the core of things.
We've never been disappointed by one of his thoughts.
Yeah,
and,
he's very good.
Yeah. So
excellent. So we hope that you got something out of it. I know I did, and hope to talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah. So good night, everybody.
Good night, folks.
And,